Thanks for. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to speak today. It's a real privilege to be here in Frankfurt talking to you. And I'm hoping that although we are all from the same publishing industry, there are some lessons that can be learnt from what we're doing that you might find interesting to apply yourselves. So I'm Stephen Dunn. I work for Guardian News and Media in the UK. We publish two UK national newspapers, The Guardian and The Observer, as well as the Guardian.co.uk website, and a lot of other digital services as well. I actually work in the digital development team as a head of technology strategy. And although I couldn't claim to be a digital native, I'm a little bit old for that, I have been working on the internet in one way or another since 1995. And I joined The Guardian at the start of its digital journey, from the point where we really started to put The Guardian online in 99. And I guess the title of my talk, Beyond Publishing, How We Open Up to Our Users. I mean, what do I mean by beyond publishing? I mean, what I'm going to talk about is the activities that we're doing as a publisher that are beyond the provision of content, beyond just publishing content on web pages. I'm sure that the world's and the challenges facing STM members and news publishers are quite different, but we do have some things in common. We're probably both feeling some of the same disruptive forces that the digital revolution of the last 15 years has brought. Actually, my background before I was in the news industry was as a user or consumer of STM services. I was a postgrad student in computational neuroscience when the web was invented, and the computer skills that I gained doing that were quite useful during my career transition. I mean, even in 99, as I left academia, the internet was already revolutionizing scientific publishing and the sharing of data. I remember at conferences I used to attend as a postgrad, there was always talk of collaboratively produced internet databases. But let's end the biography there and onto the theme of today. I'm going to talk about the journey that we're on at The Guardian, how our strategy is shifting from simply being a publisher to also being a platform for our partners and users. Thinking about users' needs is something that hasn't always come naturally to newspaper publishers, in my experience at least. I'm going to explain how native digital publishing, what we're trying to do now, is different and goes beyond straightforward web publishing. It means that you provide a platform to your users and partners, providing value to them beyond providing just the content. Actually, the pictures I'm showing you are our new offices that we moved to a couple of years ago, which are our move was sort of coincident with the changes that I'm talking about. This is the view from our offices in North London near the European Rail Terminal, actually quite close to Nature in London, Nature Publishing. And there's a lot of building activity around. As I said, this is very much a journey. I'll explain how a new vision of mutualization from our editor-in-chief is taking place all the way across the organization, and it's finding its roots in technology, editorial, and the commercial teams. It's really about how we're moving the focus outside the building and outside the organization. I'm not sure how much it's going to map onto your experiences. Perhaps some of the things we're doing will be of interest to you. So I'll cover the platform that we built and some of the skills that we brought in, including a focus on product management and user-centered thinking. We found that this greater engagement with our users, it's brought us some success in the short term and some green shoots of new revenue, which are very important to us as we seek to manage this digital transition. And actually, most immediately, more innovation than we could have ever hoped to achieve within The Guardian. If you're interested in what I'm talking about, much of this subject is going to be available in a couple of Gartner research case studies that they've done on us. It's going to be out in the next few months. So I'll start the story right at the beginning. The Guardian started its life as a weekly newspaper in 1821. I'm going to jump through time quite quickly here. So to move forward, the owners of The Guardian set up a trust in 1936 in order to preserve certain values and ensure the long-term future of The Guardian. And the trust has certain values. Being owned by a trust means that we're fortunate enough to have a little bit more time to take a longer view, although we are very much a profit-seeking enterprise. The Guardian's values are honesty, fairness, sense of duty to the reader and the community, and they still hold today. This is C.P. Scott, who, as a former editor of the paper around the turn of the 20th century, the trust named after him and his family who set it up. And the trust was created to ensure the continuity of the Guardian, as I said, and its liberal journalism. When I say liberal here, it's quite important that we mean in the British liberal tradition, emphasising the expansion of democratic values, constitutional reform, rather than the sense that it might be used in the US. So our success online, though, has slightly changed the focus of the trust. So there's a new goal that the trust has, which brought it within reach, for The Guardian to become the world's leading liberal voice in that sense of liberalness. Of course, between 1821 and 2010, distribution has changed for The Guardian in a way that people who started a newspaper or trust couldn't imagine. These are shots from our printing plant, but if you actually have a look to bring us up to date, for example, this is how we distributed the coverage of the swine flu story. We've got print, mobile, web pages, data feeds for our community, activity on Facebook, audio, video, content partnerships. We had a partnership with the BMJ, updates on Twitter, and a raft of mobile sites and applications. I want to wind back a bit to the beginning of what I call the era of newspaper web publishing, which was the business of getting news articles onto web pages in the most efficient and commercially viable way. Our first digital forays were in 96, where The Guardian had a new media lab and a brief joint venture with Wired magazine. But it wasn't until 99 till we started putting our content on the website, as in the full content of the newspaper that we published every day. You note that you had to actually register to access anything on the site. But we actually removed that quite quickly when we realised there was potentially more potential for growth in becoming a part of the web rather than a destination on the web. And that's guided our thinking with the website ever since in terms of how we scale. And we went from being a newspaper with relatively low circulation in its peers in the UK market to being one of the most linked to and trafficked content sites in the UK and on the web. In terms of linked to, here we are. This is the top N most linked to websites on the web in 2006, and we're kind of up there in the top 10, just below the BBC and above many other news organisations. We're very proud of achieving that reach. The digital revenues at the time, a mix of display advertising, dating and classifieds, jobs. Sponsorship was quite key for us, providing sponsored sections on the site for our partners. Business-to-business and events as well. We ran a lot of summits and events like this for our professional communities. And we have a small but growing interest in business-to-business. This is our website for healthcare professionals. And the usual search advertising as well. So we found success on the web. We were very successful, but we could see that we were potentially stalling. So we relaunched Guardian.co.uk in 2008 with some core principles guiding the rebuild to try and really weave The Guardian into the fabric of the web. Our aim was to become not just a site on the web, but part of the web. So some of the key principles were permanence, make sure that everything we publish never moves. This is a quote from Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the World Wide Web. Cool URLs do not change. So we made sure that nothing ever moved. Addressability was very important. We thought that it was very important for people to be able to point at what we were talking about, point at our news articles, point at individual comments, individual videos and audio clips, because thereby those become a part of the social currency of the web and we gain more traction, gain more traffic, gain a larger audience. And discoverability as well. We focused a lot on creating as many possible routes to our content on the web as possible. So we invested in tagging and metadata, information architecture, and we made sure that when we published an article, it appeared in multiple places on the website, multiple places on the web as well. A big investment in automation of content. The investment in metadata meant that we could automatically create focused resources so we could get all of the content that was related to, say, all the commentary we'd made on Google on one page, automatically generated, no editorial involvement. And then we could create automatic navigation of results. So, I mean, I'm not going to talk too much more about content management today, but the end result of this was a quite significant uptick in our growth. So prior to our drive to become part of the web, we were very successful, and then as soon as we actually started implementing this strategy, we got to the stage where we had about 36 million unique users a month in January. So we're very happy with this. We had a majority international audience, so we were achieving the goal of, or moving towards the goal of becoming the world's leading liberal voice. We're reaching outside the UK. And I guess that was the point at which the Scott Trust realised this was achievable. So we were winning awards. We were the best newspaper website at the Webbies, the Oscars of the internet, most popular news site in the UK. And everything seemed to be going very well. We added video to the site, audio, interactives, and community as well. However, the industry was changing. This is actually from Steve Rubell's blog. He's a marketing blogger. I don't know if anyone has ever read Micro Persuasion. He actually wrote this in 2006, the imminent demise of the page view. And he forecast in 2006 that by this year, which we're actually in 2010 now, the main currency of the web in terms of online advertising was going to change. Most online newspapers sold ads at CPM rate, 1,000 times an ad has been viewed, targeted to content. And it allowed our sales department to bridge the print world with a digital world in terms of providing a measure of inventory that they could sell. But actually, rumours of its death are widely exaggerated. We still use it, but the rates that we can sell at are going through the floor. Focusing on page views, it's a major issue for news publishers. I don't know if anyone else has come across this book, Free, by Chris Anderson. You've probably discussed it. It's by the editor of Wired magazine. One of the theses of this work is that the price of content and information in the digital age tends towards zero. Now, I don't believe this to be universally true. Certainly, a lot of the content and information provided by the people in this room, it may not apply to. But the ubiquity of this, of the type of, and perhaps not the quality, but the type of news and commentary that newspapers such as The Guardian provides, the price is being, and the value is being driven down. I thought I'd provide a topical example of this. So the Ryder Cup, I'm not a golfer, but this is quite topical. Well, there's a bit of ubiquity there. The lead story on Google News, if you type in Ryder Cup, there's almost 15,000 news articles available free. So in that marketplace, anyone who's charging for that content is going to struggle. So what is our reaction to these this story? I'm sure it's probably familiar to quite a few of you, possibly not in your own industry, but you've read the newspapers. Well, here's Rupert Murdoch. He has a plan. Certainly interesting times for them. I mean, some newspapers are closing in the States, and paywalls are going up around content that for a while was free online. And Rupert's reaction to disruption has been to more closely embrace those who are prepared to pay for content, pursuing a paywall strategy. And in the UK, you can buy access to The Times and Sunday Times for at the price of, I think, £2 a week or even less for your initial opening offer. I mean, he's fairly sure that the old business model is broken. And, well, I hope that it works, but I'm not actually confident that people will necessarily pay for in the long run, or at least the audience is not going to be large enough to sustain the business at its scale. This is Clay Shirky. He's a writer and lecturer on the social and economic effects of internet technologies. You might have come across his books, Here Comes Everybody and Cognitive Surplus. He talks about the impact and of the dramatic change in the cost of collaboration on the internet and how that's affecting media in particular. Here he's actually speaking at an event we ran at The Guardian earlier this year. It was a summit for leaders across all sectors to explore how the internet and associated technologies are reshaping the world. I mean, the quote isn't actually, it's just the photograph I could find from him, but the quote isn't actually from the conference. It's from a seminal article he wrote on thinking the unthinkable about newspapers, about the unthinkable thought that the old models really are not going to translate into the new digital world, no matter how many normative statements about people who ought to pay or people must pay. It's a call to action to try new business models. The old model is broken. What will work in its place? Well, nothing will work, but everything might. It's actually a call to action to try and experiment. Here's another speaker, Alan Rusbridger, who's our editor-in-chief. And in terms of finding a way to the future, our most interesting experiments lie in combining what we know with the experience, opinions, and expertise of the people who want to participate rather than passively receive. I mean, he's also, in fact, said that the London Times paywall would put the publication into a vault of darkness. That shows where we stand on that issue. I mean, as I said, I hope they do succeed, but I'm not sure whether they will. Fortunately, at The Guardian, we have access to great illustrators. This is André Krause's illustration of the traditional walled garden approach to news publishing. A group of journalists in the cathedral broadcasting to the audience. In fact, some of them seem to have been hurt by what we've done. I don't know if that's a guy down there. So I guess the point here is we actually know that many of our audience know a lot more than us about the subjects that we write about. But I think more interesting for us commercially, our potential partners may be able to be in a better position to create value around what we're doing than we can internally. And with the value of news deflating, we need all the help that we can get with that. If we look back through the values of the Scott Trust, which owns The Guardian, we can see that it's not going to work becoming the world's leading liberal voice by shutting down in this way. We need to make open work. So the journalists are more in a world where the reader is now looking back at them, with often they're knowing more than the journalists do, and contributing. Our editorial and business philosophy is to follow an open and shared direction of travel. We've got some way to go. And I realise that what we are doing, which I'm going to talk about next, it's far from us who are working on this strategy, but and we're not really the first to market, but I think we're the first traditional media owner to do this. So back to our success on the era of web publishing. We were growing, but we found that internet was growing even faster. Despite our great offering, the gap between the pace of innovation that we could provide inside the building and outside was very striking. I mean, 36 million users is not very much compared with the engagement that people like Facebook are getting. Our competition is not just against other content providers, it's for the attention of our users. There's now actually over 1 billion internet users out there. So seeing the perspective of the scale of growth in the internet, we realised we couldn't really match that. It's not just about growing the traffic to guardian.co.uk. It was about how could we embrace the scale of the internet and the community of developers and readers and partners and users that want to work with us or could create more value using our stuff. It's going to take more than just building this on our own, and we need to think about things a little differently. Now, this is Mike Bracken, our Director of Development. He actually spoke at the STM Innovations meeting last year. Well, there's the quote. A significant thing is to think about The Guardian as a platform, not just a publisher. Now, I'm not sure, I'm not going to get too technically, I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with what a platform is. A system that can be customised and adapted and built on to meet countless needs and niches that the original creators could not possibly have contemplated, much less had time to accommodate. That's from Mark Andreessen, who invented the Netscape browser, but it's kind of a good definition. So what sort of platform could we produce? The best platforms are open, so people can climb on board, make it easiest for partners and collaborators to work. We began looking at what have we got that we could provide to help others to drive mutual benefit. So from publisher to platform, or as my colleague Matt McAllister put it, how I stopped worrying about my website and learned to love the whole internet. And Matt was one of the people that we brought in to make this change. He actually ran the Yahoo developer network before he came to The Guardian. And he formulated the open strategy of The Guardian and led this project, which has really become the core focus for much of our product development. So what is the open strategy? Well, there are sort of two wings to it. Open in, bring in the best of what there is to our existing audience, make it easy for us to improve what we have. But also to allow partners to share in what we've produced. Can we provide a platform to bring partners on board and actually give them more of a voice, more of a profile? And open out, looking outwards, we should be distributing our content, our ads, and whatever else we do across the internet to provide scale. But also, in doing that, can we allow partners to build their own applications using our content and services and further their own business? And then can we share in that value they create? So there's two halves, open in and open out, and we proceeded to actually implement those in a platform that brought people in. So in 2009, we launched the open platform and started to make this real. We called it the suite of services that enable partners to build applications with The Guardian. And I could now go into a very technical explanation how it works, but I'm not going to. I'm actually going to more talk about what we've actually achieved with it. Essentially, the proposition was that we produced a means for people to automatically come and get our content through a content API. That's the end of the technical explanation. But if you want to find out a bit more about that, you can talk to me afterwards. What we found is that people started to produce innovative applications that we would never have produced ourselves. Now, some of them are toy applications. Some of them are actually providing business value. So here's an example of something that was done quickly within the first 24 hours of us releasing the content. Somebody was finding reviews of concerts that The Guardian had published and matching those on Twitter to reviews that users had published and producing basically something that combined the two together. Websites started to integrate our content without us having to do any work. The Cascopt Foundation, for example, in London, they commission and sculptures from British artists, and they added content to their website simply by using our API. Something a bit more commercial. It's a large social networking site, Goal Run in the UK. It was keen to offer users football news. Our open platform made it incredibly easy for them to take our content and build a magazine channel on their site. And this, we basically take a revenue share from them, and we increase the reach of our content as well. Here's a bit of innovation. Phil Gifford, a developer from the UK, built the version of The Guardian that he wanted to see, which had some very interesting navigation, a kind of swipe-like navigation that you see on touch screens, a very simple navigation. And this is something that you can try it yourself on guardian.gifford.com. It's something that we've been interested in, but we've never got around to doing. He's published it. It's out there live every day, and it's running our advertising. Similarly, new ways of putting a spotlight on long-form content. The developer Dan Catt used the API to build a site called The Long Good Read, which just takes the long-form content from The Guardian and publishes it in a means that makes it very easy to move onto tablet devices, touchscreen devices, things like the Kindle. So, I mean, the important thing for all of these is that we are building up a network of advertisers with our partners. We're not just giving away the content for free. There's something that we're getting in return. And more on the business model later. The other thing we started to open up was data. A data store. The Guardian's got a history of campaigning for open data, and as we know it, there's often a source of data behind a good news story. Useful data that matters, but you don't always get to see it. We actually started on this a long time ago, going back to the start of my talk. If you turn over the first ever copy of The Guardian, there's actually a set of data tables on the back of it about school fees in Manchester, so there's a bit of history there. We're actually building up a reputation for data journalism. This is Simon Rogers, who edits our data blog. And on the data blog, we publish the data that matters behind the news story. So here, here's something that's quite serious, a typical news story. We take all of the British and dead and wounded in Afghanistan. People actually were taking this data and creating visualizations that tell new stories. I guess the really interesting thing here is we are creating a bit of an ecosystem of developers who are into creating visualizations. Visualizations actually have quite a lot of value on the internet in terms of being very attractive destinations for users, and we're building that community around us. This is becoming a lot easier. Here's one of our developers. We're finding that for some of these things, we can build software in less time than it takes to describe it. It sounds a bit facetious, but the next example I'm going to tell you was built in a couple of weeks, something I wouldn't have dreamed of a few years ago of doing. Here's an interesting news story. This is not my shopping list. It's an expenses receipt from a UK Member of Parliament. Anyone who's from the UK, this is actually from Margaret Moran, the Labour MP for Luton South. You may recall there was a political scandal last year where it was revealed that many members of Parliament were claiming more than the taxpayers expected them to in their expenses. That's probably the most legally safe way of putting that. The full unexpurgated documents were leaked to the Daily Telegraph, and they invested a huge amount of time investigating this. And then later on, over 500,000 documents and scans of receipts were distributed publicly. It would have taken us years to go through that. Now, we realised there was no way we could possibly review all this ourselves, so we built an application that allowed our audience to review them and bring the news to our attention. And we sort of treated it a little bit like a game by experimenting people to participate, see how many you can review, help us review and find the dirt or find the interesting stuff. And this allowed us to review 500,000 documents with a team of about 20 or so reporters, and to gain a huge advantage with the hundreds of readers who participated. So here we are, looking outside the building, engaging our users to actually facilitate our core mission. It doesn't all have to be serious. We release data about light entertainment as well, every single journey through time by Doctor Who, and we get visualizations. These are very popular as well. But our experience with data is bringing us into the world of open government data as well. And we're building a network of partners. This is actually a photo of a hack day where we brought in some of the best developers of political applications, civic hackers on the web. And they spent 24 hours producing demos and prototypes around our data. And we built up such a reputation around that that when the UK government decided that it was going to push into opening up government data, this is Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, at The Guardian, at the launch of the UK government data store. And I guess our profile around this meant that when they actually wanted to launch it, they brought that to The Guardian, and we organised a hack day to build some of the initial applications. We brought our community of engaged users and developers around that and really helped them with their launch. So I think this is a very interesting avenue for us as a publisher in terms of more business-to-business revenue, that by bringing our community together, we can actually build an expertise in this new field of open government data. Politics API, The Guardian's very famous for political coverage. We now release all of our 2 decades' worth of our UK political database. It powered a large number of politics applications in the run-up to the parliamentary elections in the UK this year. Here's one of my favourites. You can enter in your postcode, and it tells you how much power you actually have as a voter. So in the UK, we have a first-past-the-post system. Some people think this is controversial. Some people think it's great. But this application actually took our data from the UK. It wasn't actually built by us. It was built by someone we'd never met before, ended up being touted on the national news. Something that we had never built, but it's actually, it's not ours, but it's core to our values, and it was actually powered by our data. So I've talked a lot about some of the things that people have built, but what about a business model? So this year, we came out of beta with our open platform, declaring that we're open for business. The API offering completely changed scale. We moved that out of our technology infrastructure into the cloud. And there were two main changes. The first one, a business model, where we actually divided the access into 3 tiers. There's a free access where people can come along, don't even have to know who they are. They can take our headlines programmatically, do what they want with them, just have to link back to us. There's an approved tier where you can take the full article content, and then we embed advertising, and we embed tracking as well, so we get to build our network. And there's a partner tier where our partners see basically what we see inside The Guardian. The aim of this is that you could basically rebuild everything we've done using an API key. The idea being that we can now go to market, find partners, find intelligent people out there and actually get them to build stuff for us with minimal onboarding cost. It's very difficult to do that stuff before. So, and then we just negotiate the revenue model. So we're expecting to maybe have about 10 apps a year in the core mode, about 100 or so in the niche mode, and, well, we don't care how many there are in the completely open mode. We're just hoping there are as many as possible. And so far, we've had about 3,000 users, developers sign up, several hundred apps as well. And the second thing that we did, I talked a lot about Open Out, is that along with the APIs that I've been talking about so far, we added a fourth one, micro-apps, which basically allows us to bring stuff into the Guardian. And that really picked up the missing leg of our strategy, opening. It's a framework for integrating third-party applications into Guardian.co.uk. I'll give you an example of this. Basically, I'm not going to go into the tech here, but suffice it to say the results are it makes services that people outside the building have provided as if they were ours to our internal staff and our users, very simply. So, for example, a developer called Dan Levitt took content from our Open Out service, so using the other services I've been talking about. He found all of our recipe content. He plugged that into his recipe website, Recipe Finder. What can I cook? It's one of these sites where you say, I've got this in my fridge. What can I cook? And it provides recipes. I mean, not many people have got that kind of stuff in their fridge. It's something that we would have never have built ourselves or got round to building ourselves, but it creates a lot of value because previously our recipe content was just up there in web pages. He's now turned it into a recipe application. Using the OpenIn framework that we built, he's plugged it back into the site. So we've now got a fabulous application for our users that didn't cost us anything, and we've just worked out a revenue share deal with him. He gets to use the recipes on his site. We share the revenue of the advertising on there. We get Recipe Finder for free on our site. As it turns out, Life and Star is very good commercially for us in terms of advertising revenue. A more sort of hardcore, concrete example of how this approach changes our commercial strategy. A typical newspaper website deal would be we'd meet an advertiser, publish a special supplement in the newspaper, perhaps a special section on the website. And so a typical example of this would be the English Tourist Board, Enjoy England. Their campaign was called The Full English. And basically, we would typically do a deal where we would publish a special section on the website and some inserts in the newspaper. Well, they came to us and they wanted something a bit more interesting. And because of the open platform, we were able to provide that, something more sophisticated, a social networking type thing which had an existent on our site and on their site, which also used content from The Guardian seamlessly. We partnered with a third party. I'm not going to explain exactly how this works, but essentially we have the Enjoy England site here, our site there, and a third party developer all tied together using the APIs that we've built. So LingoB, our developer, took content from the content API, built an application and plugged it in to both websites, and the application was republished on both websites, and it gave our advertiser a much more engaging package that we could have ever done normally, or at least it would have required a huge effort that may not have actually outweighed the cost of the sponsorship. And we made a sale that basically beat our competitors as a result of having the platform. So we're hoping to just be able to continue to use this this method, but there's a much more much simpler way of actually using openness to drive scale, and that's building networks. So after building this technology platform, we thought, well, what else can we do to help the ordinary user participate, or at least the user that doesn't necessarily have a large business behind them? We're thinking, how can we widen access to the content further to build our business? Well, the world's most popular blogging tool, WordPress, looked like a potential area. And we created a tool to allow bloggers to embed Guardian content, plus our ads and our tracking, straight into their blogs with no software, just push button. And we launched this a couple of months ago, and we already have hundreds of users publishing our content. And we have intentional drives to build out these networks. We We've got the largest green ad network on the internet, I believe, by pulling together bloggers and sites. We do revenue share deals with... we're kind of curating high-quality environment blogging content. And most recently, I guess a bit more relevant to the audience here, Guardian Science Blogs Network. We recruited a lot of people who were running their own science blogs, built a network out of them. The bloggers actually use our open platform to... they publish content on the Guardian site and then republish it out into their blogs using the WordPress tool that I talked about. We sell ads against the bloggers' pages and we split the revenue with them. So there's a whole lot of revenue opportunities from being open to our users. We can embed ads in the network we create. There's behavioural targeting opportunities. Now we've got this larger network. We can potentially resell and redistribute data using our expertise in data journalism. We can possibly sell services around the data. And we're already starting to create more innovating and engaging sponsorships. So really, we are moving from being a publisher to being a platform. We are seeking massive growth, but we're not just broadcasting our content anymore. And we are increasing our engagement with our users through journalism, data, software, applications, and advertising. And we're having to massively scale to achieve that. So I'll probably close off talking about the open platform now and start talking about some of the skills that we brought into the organization to actually increase our engagement with users. So one of the other large transformations of The Guardian that we've seen in the way that we do things has been the introduction of user-centered thinking in how we develop our products. And I'm going to give some examples as to how that thinking has helped us in our product development. The biggest change, really, is introduction of product management discipline. So for most of the lifetime of The Guardian digitally, our projects have been run by project managers and business analysts, or a combination of the two. Project managers are there to deliver a specific project to budget and time, and business analysts look at a business process and turn that into a set of requirements. I'm sure you use them yourself. But in simple terms, a product manager is responsible for the overall success of a product from its birth to its burial, the whole product life cycle. And they maximize a product's return on investment, and they evaluate the product in the marketplace, talk to the users, own the P&L, and accountable to the stakeholders. So that's a big change for us. And we basically... made the transition and stopped, basically got rid of our project managers and converted them into product managers. So wherever there was a product that we needed to develop, we put a product manager onto it, gave them the entire ownership, and we changed our processes. And so instead of just focusing on the kind of delivery and design and development parts of the product life cycle, they look across the entire product life cycle. As a wider process that takes the user into account with a line of responsibility direct to the user. We also practice now user-centered design. So we've got a team of usability specialists. It's small but growing. All product development now has a budget for usability study and contextual research. So we bring our users into the office. We watch them using our products. We go out onto the streets and find them, interview them, find out the context around the use of our product, and we recruit them from a very large user panel we've created called the Navigator panel that we recruited from our core audience. Now, the costs of doing this can vary from the price of buying somebody a nice cup of coffee to the hiring of specialist labs for observing our product in the wild. Another change that we've wrought is insight into our customers. So most newspaper sales teams traditionally have research departments who are there to discover the audience and provide sales cases. And what we've done at The Guardian is we've actually reformulated that department into a core customer insight department that they're responsible for all insight into our users, not only just providing sales cases, but also providing the tools to allow us to track the success of our products and plan new product development. And this screenshot is a very scientific-looking tool that we pour all of our customer data into. It's called Insight. It's produced by Omniture. And it allows our customer insight team to slice and dice and actually discover the paths our users are taking through our website and segment them. And I'm going to give an example of something else that we've done to transform how we publish in a user-centered way. A couple of years ago, I brought in to the organization a team of search engine optimization experts. And one of the things they did, as well as search engine optimization — does everybody understand what I mean by that? So as well as the traditional SEO search engine optimization activities, such as adding keywords to articles to make them more findable on the web, we actually looked at our overall publishing strategy to try and see if we could optimize it based on how our users were navigating the content. So we looked at how and when we were publishing content online. So this chart shows the frequency of publication by hour across the period of a week. So you've got the 24 hours of the day at the bottom and the number of articles published by The Guardian. As you can see, there's a massive spike at midnight, which is when the newspaper goes to press. And everything is launched on the website at that point. Well, that's how it used to be. If we actually look at a particular, say, news article — so this is a football article, for example — you'd see that there'd be a football match, and the day before, all the content in the newspaper would be published at midnight online, and then after the match, everything would be published at midnight, maybe something the following day. And we traced how the publication time correlated with the appearance on websites such as Google News and blogs. And we realized this was a very inefficient way of reaching people. It might have been efficient in terms of the production process, but not necessarily in terms of pleasing users. So we actually worked to change this and actually slowly rolled out the content throughout the day. I mean, we're still publishing the content when the news happens, but rather than having it in two chunks, we're now trying to spread it out. So we started reducing our midnight peak down and spreading out the publication load throughout the day. Now, we found by doing this, we actually had some dramatic changes in the success of our website. So if you just look at the traffic, before the optimization in a particular section of the website, we were seeing almost 100% growth in page views and visitors as a result of actually timing our publication to when our users were actually trying to consume it, as opposed to timing it to our traditional print deadlines. So that's an example of how user-centered thinking has changed our publication strategy. That's quite fundamental for a newspaper workflow to do something like that. So I'm now going to talk about mobile and how we've put together our user-centered thinking to create some great products. I should say that a lot of this work that we've done on mobile that's been very successful has been led by our product manager, John Moore, and our business development team. So The Guardian was quite late to the mobile sphere, and apart from some early success in 2001, when we had a few mobile WAP sites — I don't know if anyone remembers WAP — we were quite late to the game in terms of providing mobile solutions for our users and our customers. But nonetheless, mobile was affecting how we did business. So when we covered a story, we would see reactions on Twitter, we would get photographs sent to us, we would have videos sent to us as well, very famously, when Ian Tomlinson — I don't know if everyone, there was a famous G20 protests in London, a protester ended up dying after the police pushed him over. Somebody sent us the video that they'd taken on their mobile phone. So the impact of the ubiquity of mobile was actually affecting the way we covered. But we covered the news, but we didn't actually have a product ourselves in the market. There was ample evidence that we really should. Certainly, 6.2 billion on apps in 2009, 2010. So we set up a team to do this. We had a product manager, usability team, some designers, and we developed our apps using the open platform in the way that I previously discussed. We had a great focus on usability. We spent a lot of time. This is the blog of John Henry Barak, who did a lot of the wireframing and usability work on the mobile application. And our strategy was to develop a portfolio of apps rather than a single app. So we developed along two lines, a m.guardian, a mobile version that works in most devices. That's now getting about 7 million page impressions a month from about a million users. And we developed a very successful iPhone app that had about 100. It's actually a paid-for application. So our strategy here is the content is free on m.guardian.co.uk, but we're quite happy to charge for utility in the form of an application. And the feedback we got was very complimentary, and it ended up being showcased in Apple's television campaigns. And the iPad, well, we launched a free application to coincide with the iPad, and that was sponsored by Canon. This was developed in 8 weeks from drawing board to this.
We got a lot of news apps, Reuters, The Wall Street Journal.
I don't know if anyone recognizes this.
USA
voice.
Today.
This is Steve Jobs.
The New York Times.
iPad.
Time Magazine. This is a cool app, Guardian Eyewitness. This basically says, rather than text, let's give you the day in pictures. And it's really nice.
So Steve Jobs thinks it's really nice. but seriously, we were very pleased with that. We actually had an idea, and 2 months later, we were showcased at the launch of the iPad. We had over 100,000 downloads in the first month, and we're way beyond this now. We're on a very significant number of the devices that are out there on the market, and our mobile roadmap evolves. I don't believe we could have done that without a focus on product management, our traditional project management and design-led approach would not have delivered something of this quality quite so quickly. Now, the other thing that we are finding is that the mobile space is providing us a great way of actually talking to our demanding users. So a lot of the feedback and a lot of the direction on the mobile roadmap is driven by the feedback we get on channels such as Twitter, as you can see here, one of our production team responding to the user here. And also, when the product's in the palm of your customer's hand, the feedback's amazing. And we're finding that we're just able to basically produce a better product simply by listening to what our users want. We're also finding that mobile is filling a gap in the touch points that we have with our users. So you can see here with this graph, we traditionally, with guardian.co.uk, there's a great big peak in the middle of the day, carries on late into the day because of our international US coverage. Video as well, a big lunchtime peak. But the mobile application and the m.guardian.co.uk mobile-friendly website, we find a new audience at the beginning of the day. And this kind of research is what we're doing, what has arisen from our focus on product development. So I'm going to round off now so I can take a few questions. I just thought I would leave you with a few of the lessons that anyone wanting to follow in our footsteps might want to learn from, which I'll deliver in sort of a classic bullet point form, I think, yes. So, I mean, the first thing is, if you are being disrupted, consider how it fits in with your mission. Don't just follow the crowd and copy what other publishers are doing. What can you do to actually ride the disruption? And you should perhaps look at opportunities to open up your business model to exploit the capabilities of people, your users and your partners. Are people not doing business with you because it's too hard? You need to provide some value there, obviously. If you're on the web, How can your digital services grow beyond having a presence on the web to being a valuable component of the wider internet? It's more than just the web now. And look at your organization's skills. Are you user-centered or are you looking inwards? So I think I'll close now, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak and talk about our story. I hope it's been useful or at least interesting to see it from our perspective. I think there's time for a few questions, and you can really ask me about anything.
Before anybody starts talking, please make sure you have the microphone in your hand and give us very clearly who you are.
Who we are, what we are as well. I'm Dick Rudick, Copyright Clearance Center. As I was listening to you, I found it fascinating. I found myself wondering about the implications for intellectual property of this very open, this very accessible, this iterative process. Does it make intellectual property more important, less important? Do you think about it differently? Does it have no impact? Does it solve some of the problems that we face?
That's a very good question. We did spend a lot of time thinking about rights and intellectual property when we did this. So I suppose the biggest transformation inside the organization was this was a project that kind of was launched somewhat from the technology team, but it only succeeded because we actually got everyone around the table and decided that we were going to solve this problem together. So the rights team, which is quite a large part of what we do at The Guardian in terms of clearing rights, were very much involved in this. And there is rights integration in the open platform. So it's only within the partner tier can developers actually see what we can see. Everything outside that partner tier is rights cleared, and actually the current software development drive is to fully integrate our sophisticated internal rights database with the open platform rights so that we can actually synchronize rights information live. Now, in terms of actually how we manage the rights, part of the terms and conditions that you sign up for is that you have to, your application must revalidate with our repository every 24 hours so that if we need to take something down due to a rights issue, that automatically happens. And so that covers a lot of the queries. There are obviously some rights holders who prefer not to have their content, but hopefully we can show them the value of having it in there. So I think it actually makes rights a lot more important, because before we did this, people were coming to our website and taking stuff without our permission anyway. We had RSS feeds. People were just coming and taking and doing that. Now we actually have a framework in which we actually encourage people to use that. They sign up to terms and conditions, and we can start to actually enforce those rights. So I think I would want to put openness not in opposition to free, but it's orthogonal. So openness does not mean free. There's open and closed and free and paid. And we want to play in the quadrant which is open and paid, not necessarily free, as it were.
I'm David Thomas with Thomson Reuters Scholar One. Question I have for you, when you look at the model of newspapers before the advent or the utilization of the internet, where they basically were like selling subscriptions online to the content, and you take a look at all of your revenue now you're getting from these various different applications and from selling and partnering and things like that, and do some kind of a comparison, are you net greater in total revenue than before, or any kind of comparisons of the two models looking forward? Because you've done a radical change over trying to utilize your content and monetize your content versus the old models before. Do you have any kind of comments about that?
Yeah, I don't think we will ever retain the revenues that newspapers used to have, whichever model we do, whichever model we occupy. We haven't thrown away our old models. We still charge cover price for the newspaper, and you can still buy a subscription to the newspaper. In fact, we launched a new subscription model only a few months ago to get your newspaper delivered at 7 a.m. in the morning. The new models are nowhere near in terms of being as financially successful as, say, the revenues that we were pulling in a number of years ago. Having said that, we've taken an immense amount of cost out of the business in terms of last year, A, by making it much easier to do business, but also just as a result of the advertising recession, we have taken a large amount of cost out of the business. So it's too early to say whether or not we will ever come and meet those old revenues, but I'm not the head of our... I'm not our commercial director. I'm a little, some way distant from that, but I can't believe we would ever get back to the previous levels we were. I don't think anybody will. I don't think that the Times of London will achieve that. Then it's the market forces have changed that forever.
David Warlock. I agree strongly the Times of London will never do that, and I congratulate you on what you've done at The Guardian. The thing that still puzzles me, however, is how you come by your mandate. It sounded at the beginning of your talk almost as if the trustees had met together upon a cloud somewhere and decided on a greater vision in which Manchester liberalism of the 1890s free trade variety would be carried to the world. There are 36 million people out there. Who drives now what The Guardian says? Is it the 300,000 who buy the paper copy? Is it the 36 million? How does this revolution you've made in distribution get into the revolution which is coming in thinking?
That's a very good point. It's something that is very much a moving target. I mentioned the word mutualization. I probably didn't talk about it as much as I could. And one of the reasons why is that it's very clearly being taken up as a mantle by the editorial side of the business, and most of our editorial product development involves some element of mutualization. For me, the product, the bit of the platform that I'm working on now that we're delivering this, is an identity management system to allow us to start to recognize some of those 36 million users, build up profiles for them in order to bring them on board as individuals. So maybe I'll come back some other time and tell you about how that went. But in terms of actually who is the voice, we invest a lot in curation, I think, as a technique. So we have a large number of online means of users contributing their voice. Our comment pages, instead of having tens of columnists, we have hundreds of columnists in our Comment is Free product. We commission a comment and opinion from around the world. And then below the line, we have a very vibrant user community that contributes their voice to that. Now, we actually have a focus on building community and curating community. So rather than just having a moderation team which removes swear words and troublemakers, we're actually actively trying to promote good conversation, and we'll be seeking in the future to actually elevate people who are trusted by maybe giving them badges or in some way actually having some kind of what's known in some internet forums as karma systems to try to actually promote people. Now, in terms of whether the voice will change, that's a very interesting question. That's one for the editor-in-chief, but certainly our aim is to try and add more voices to cover. And I think, I'm not sure how it's going to pan out, but I can imagine we are hoping that our voice will carry our community with us rather than us perhaps being taken over by, I don't think that's how we think it. I'm not sure where that, if that's what you were getting at, but I don't think there's a fear of us being swamped by the 36 million. There's actually a target you can actually identify in the world, do research of the number of liberal thinking people out there, and our aim is there's not 36 million of them in the UK, but maybe we can get the 1 million people that are.
Okay, if there are no more questions, then I would like to thank Stephen, first of all.
Thank you.